Welcome, brethren and sisters and young people, to our fifth study, in which our brother Roger Lewis will lead us under the subject Jonathan the Selfless, Loving Counsel and Tragic Death. We'll start this afternoon firstly with a hymn, hymn number 48. Introduction to our brother Roger's remarks, he has asked that we read from 1 Samuel chapter 31. And our brother Jim Lund will read that for us.
Reading together with you from the first book of Samuel, chapter 31. Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell down slain in Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines followed hard upon Saul and upon his sons, and the Philistines slew Jonathan and Abinadab and Melchishua, Saul's sons. And the battle went sore against Saul, and the archers hit him, and he was sore wounded of the archers. Then said Saul unto his armour-bearer, Draw thy sword, and thrust me through therewith, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through, and abuse me. But his armour-bearer would not, for he was sore afraid. Therefore Saul took a sword, and fell upon it. And when his armour-bearer saw that Saul was dead, he fell likewise upon his sword, and died with him. So Saul died, and his three sons, and his armour-bearer, and all his men that same day together. And when the men of Israel that were on the other side of the valley, and they that were on the other side Jordan, saw that the men of Israel fled, and that Saul and his sons were dead, they forsook the cities and fled, and the Philistines came and dwelt in them. And it came to pass on the morrow, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, that they found Saul and his three sons fallen in Mount Gilboa. And they cut off his head, and stripped off his armour, and sent into the land of the Philistines round about, to publish it in the house of their idols and among the people. And they put his armour in the house of Ashtaroth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan. And when the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard of that which the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose and went all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his son from the wall of Bethshan and came to Jabesh and burnt them there. And they took their bones and buried them under a tree at Jabesh and fasted 7 days.
Jim, I now invite your close attention to our brother Roger Lewis as he speaks to us concerning Jonathan the Selfless, Loving Counsel and Tragic Death.
Well, thank you, Brother Chairman, my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, and my dear young people. Well, it's a warm afternoon, and we're going to need to concentrate. But we reach this afternoon the climax, really, of the story of Jonathan as we approach him now upon the heights of Gilboa, as we've read together in the 1 Samuel chapter 31, and we see the final outworking of the story concerning his life's purpose and his dedication to the cause of David. You'll remember that in our last study, if you turn back to the 20th chapter, in the 1 Samuel chapter 20 and verse 42, that we left Jonathan and David on the occasion of their departure one from the other, having kissed each one his friend and wept each one upon his friend, that it was Jonathan who characteristically had sent David away. And you'll remember how the record closes at the end of the 42nd verse, with Jonathan standing upon a small rise, as it were, with a lump in his throat and his hands and his legs feeling like lead, as he watched his friend recede into the distance, into the dangers and worries and anxieties of exile, he himself to return to the presence of the king and the royal court and the mood of mad obsession and hatred that dominated that place. And you know, one could forgive Jonathan at that time for wondering what exactly the purpose of the truth was. You see, all Jonathan had sought to do was to be faithful to God, faithful to his friend, faithful to his father. And as a result of exhibiting or endeavouring to exhibit those qualities in his life, what now has come upon him? He's lost the trust of his father. He's lost the hope of the kingdom. He's forfeited the right to the throne. and he's just seen his best friend walk away. And one can imagine, or at least forgive Jonathan for wondering, as it were, in what way he might be rewarded for faithful endeavour in the things of the truth. He will be rewarded, brothers and sisters, but the time of reward for Jonathan was not yet to come, and there was as yet more trial that lay ahead of him. You'll remember that when David left, he went to Nob. We're told that in chapter 21 and verse 1. Then came David to Nob, to Ahimelech. Of course, Doeg the Edomite was there. And in fear for his life and in concern of Saul finding out where he was, we're told in the 10th verse that David arose and fled that day for fear of Saul and went to Achish, king of Gath. And that was a mistake. And so in chapter 22 and verse 1, we read that David therefore departed thence and escaped to the cave Adullam. But that wasn't a good place either, because in the 5th verse, the prophet Gad said unto David, "Abide not in the hole, depart and get thee into the land of Judah." And David departed and came into the forest of Herod. And we gain the idea of a young and inexperienced David slipping from place to place, trying to adjust with these new dilemmas that came upon him as his character was being developed by Yahweh, his almighty Father. And in the 23rd chapter, we're told in the 13th verse, having rescued the inhabitants of Keilah from disaster, in the 1st of Samuel 23 and verse 13, it says, "Then David and his men, which were about 600, arose and departed out of Keilah and went whithersoever they could go. And it was told Saul that David was escaped from Keilah, and he forbore to go forth. And David abode in the wilderness in strongholds and remained in a mountain in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul sought him every day, but God delivered him not into his hand. And David saw that Saul was come out to seek his life, and David was in the wilderness of Ziph in a wood." When it says in the 14th verse that David abode in the wilderness in strongholds, the phrase strongholds is better rendered mountain heights. He was up on a mountain. And in fact, a short distance to the south of the wilderness of Ziph, by the outskirts of the town that bears the same name, there is a very prominent mountain that rises up with a commanding view of all the wilderness territory round about. We believe it was probably in this very mountain to the south of Ziph that on this occasion David abode, and it was a densely wooded place. But it gave David a commanding vision of the area around about, and as a result of that, we're told in the 15th verse that David saw. He could see some of the movements of Saul. And he could see that Saul was come out to seek his life. And he was in the wilderness of Ziph, in a wood. And this was a time of tremendous anxiety for David as he endeavoured every day to keep his men safely away from Saul. He was still as yet only a young man, inexperienced to the demands of leading 600 men and those malcontents and bitter of soul at that. And David must have had his heart in his mouth day by day as he endeavoured to protect his men against the advances of the army of Saul. And one gets the impression that the morale of David and the spirit of David was gradually falling day by day as the pressures wore him down. Playing cat and mouse through the wilderness. Every day, not sure. Every day, heart and mouth. And to add distress to that was the fact that he had been betrayed by the inhabitants of Keilah. And Keilah is a city of Judah. His own tribe had betrayed him. We believe that during that time, all of the time between chapter 20 and chapter 23, that Jonathan would have been in touch with David. How they got their messages through, we're not told. But I've no doubt that Jonathan, being the man that he was, and having the love for David that he did, there would be no way that Jonathan would not in some way maintain communication with David all through that time, perilous though it might be. And perhaps Jonathan had sensed that there was a growing difficulty in the mind of David as his spirit slumped further and further into despair until the time came when Jonathan appreciated, and this would be many, many months after the 20th chapter, that there came a time when Jonathan understood that David needed his help. And we're told in the 16th verse, and Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David into the wood and strengthened his hand in God. You know, this is a remarkable little story, this one. You'll be amazed at what we find here in the 16th, 17th and 18th verses. It's a lovely little story. And of course, the first thing that many people have commented upon, and rightly so, is the amazing contrast between verse 14 and verse 16. Because, you see, verse 14 tells us that Saul sought David every day, but found him not. But when Jonathan arose in the 16th verse, he went straight to David in the wood and had absolutely no trouble in finding him immediately. That was remarkable, wasn't it? You see what verse 16 says? Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went. Now you see that phrase there, arose and went. You see, that's a connection back to the 20th chapter. Let's go back to that last episode again. Chapter 20, verse 42. You see, what we're being told here is there's a deliberate connection between the last time that Jonathan occurs in the record. Now you see, at the end of chapter 20 and verse 42, it says that David arose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. And now in chapter 23 and verse 16, it says, and Jonathan arose and went to David. Now you see the point of those two passages when we bring them together side by side. You see, what we're being told in chapter 23 and verse 16 is during all the time of chapter 21 and chapter 22 and chapter 23, when Saul hunted for David, Jonathan was at home. He never, ever left the city until now. He never joined in the activities of his father in the matter of endeavouring to hunt down David. And between chapter 20, verse 42, when he says goodbye to David, and chapter 31, when he appears on the mountaintops of Gilboa, apart from this one brief reference to him in chapter 23, Jonathan's name disappears entirely from the scriptural record, from chapter 21 to chapter 31 of the 1st of Samuel. All the years that Saul hunted David, Jonathan is not with his father. You know, there's an important principle in that. You see, sometimes we find that we come across circumstances in life where we're powerless to do anything positive for the truth. It's not possible for us at times to take matters into our own hands and shape them as we might like to shape them for the good of the truth. But it's always possible to abstain from evil. And when you're powerless to do everything else, young people, we can at least abstain from that which is wrong. Come and have a look at Luke chapter 23. Here's the spirit of Jonathan in the life of another disciple. There was little else Jonathan could do. But at least he made the point of staying home and saying, I have no part and parcel of these plans to capture David in order that he might be killed. Luke 23, verse 50. And behold, there was a man named Joseph, a counselor. One of the ruling men was he, and he was a good man and a just. The same had not consented to the counsel and deed of them. See that? When the Saul class in Christ's day made plans that they might track down Jesus and take him and kill him, Joseph of Arimathea abstained from that which was evil. He says, I have no part of that. He consented not to their evil deed. That's the spirit of Jonathan, isn't it? If even that's the only thing we might be able to do, then do it. Abstain from evil. Now that's the force of that little phrase in the 1st of Samuel 23, verse 16, that Jonathan arose and went to David. He went to David in the wood. And so when we come back to that phrase, the 1st of Samuel 23 and verse 16, we're not told, of course, exactly how Jonathan tracked them down. Maybe they were in communication. Maybe Jonathan always knew where David was. He no doubt was always with David in spirit, but you know, there's another principle, of course, behind verse 16, and that says that whatever the circumstances were that allowed Jonathan to find David, we know this, that Yahweh permitted this meeting to take place. Yahweh allowed this meeting in the wood to occur. And verse 16 goes on to say that Jonathan, having found David in the wood, strengthened his hand in God. It appears that David at this time had very little to contribute. He needed the encouragement of his friend. And Jonathan enacted that role of providing wise counsel and advice to a friend in time of need. You know, if you come back to the Gospel of Luke, there's a remarkable story in Luke's Gospel. It says there that Jonathan went to him in the wood and strengthened his hand in God. Luke chapter 22. He went to him in the wood, says the record. And in Luke chapter 22, we have another man, another David, another beloved, who is in time of need, and he's in the wood. He's in the wood of Gethsemane. And he needs the comfort of his disciples that they might help him. And we're told in Luke chapter 22 and verse 39, and as he came out, he went as he was wont to the Mount of Olives and to the wood of Gethsemane, as it were, and his disciples followed him. But verse 45 tells us that they failed to live up to the example of Jonathan, because when he rose from prayer and was come to his disciples, he found them sleeping for sorrow. They never did provide the helpful advice that Christ so desperately needed from his disciples. They didn't live up to the spirit of Jonathan, you see. And because his disciples failed, God himself had to answer the need of his son. And so we're told in the 43rd verse, and there appeared an angel unto him from heaven, strengthening him. And Jonathan went to David in the wood and strengthened his hand in God. And Jonathan becomes the prototype of the angelic comforter that's finally sent by God himself to comfort his son in the wood in time of need, because the disciples on this occasion couldn't live up to the spirit of Jonathan. You see verse 43, interesting how it's worded, isn't it? There appeared an angel unto him from heaven. You think, well, where else would an angel come from? But you see, the force of the phrase from heaven is telling us that this was God's response to his son's need. When all other people had failed, when all else had failed, God responded, and an angel from heaven appeared to strengthen the son in time of need. And that's all found in the spirit of Jonathan as he went to David in the wood. There's a lesson in this, isn't there? One of the principles of true friendship is the giving of counsel. We all need times when we can receive good advice from our friends. And good advice is that which will help to set us on our way. We're told in Exodus chapter 33 and verse 11 that Yahweh spake unto Moses face to face as a man speaketh unto his friend. And that's what friends are for, to speak to each other face to face in time of need, to give counsel. Proverbs 27 verse 9, ointment and perfume rejoice the heart, so doth the sweetness of a man's friend by the counsel of the soul. That's what Jonathan was going to give David. The counsel of the soul. And counsel may also be that which not only sweetens, but braces against adversity. Proverbs 27, verse 17, iron sharpeneth iron, so a man sharpeneth the countenance of his friend. John 15, verse 15 says, I have called you friends, for all things that I have heard of my Father, I have made known unto you. And that's the purpose of friends, isn't it? To make known good counsel unto each other. That's what Jonathan did when he went to David in the wood. He gave that advice. You see what he said? 1 Samuel 23 and verse 16, it says that he strengthened his hand in God and said unto him, Fear not. You see those two words there? He strengthened his hand in God, verse 16, and said unto him, Fear not, verse 17. Do you know that those are the two identical words that Moses spoke to Joshua in Joshua chapter 1, verse 9? Perhaps we might just turn to that one. Joshua chapter 1, verse 9. He strengthened his hand in God and said, Fear not. Joshua chapter 1, verse 9. The words of Moses to Joshua, Have not I commanded thee, be strong and of a good courage, and be not afraid, neither be thou dismayed, for Yahweh thy God is with thee whithersoever thou goest. The same two words, be strong, don't be afraid. In the first of Chronicles, chapter 22, it's the same phrase used later on when David speaks to his own son, to Solomon, at the end of his days. The first of Chronicles, chapter 22, and verses 12 and 13. We're told there, perhaps reading from verse 11, Now, my son, Yahweh be with thee, and prosper thou, and build the house of Yahweh thy God, as he hath said of thee. Only Yahweh give thee wisdom and understanding, and give thee charge concerning Israel, that thou mayest keep the law of Yahweh thy God. Then shalt thou prosper, if thou takest heed to fulfill the statutes and judgments which Yahweh charged Moses with concerning Israel. Be strong and of good courage. Dread not. There's the second word. Be strong. Dread not. Because Yahweh will be with thee. In the second of Chronicles, chapter 32, we're told of some words of Hezekiah. At a time when he needed to comfort the nation because of their despair of heart, because of the threatening invasion of the Assyrian. And Hezekiah, says the record, in the second of Chronicles 32, spake to the heart of the people in these words in the seventh verse, when he said, Be strong and courageous, be not afraid nor dismayed. Be not afraid nor dismayed for the king of Assyria, nor for all the multitude that is with him. For there is more with us than with him. With him is an arm of flesh, but with us is Yahweh our God to help us and to fight our battles. And the theme of those phrases is, Yahweh is with thee. Isn't that the spirit of those passages? And those are the two words that Jonathan gives to David in the woods. He strengthened his hand in God, and said to him, Fear not. Back to the first of Samuel, chapter 23. Because you see, Jonathan went on to say in the 17th verse, For the hand of Saul my father shall not find thee, and thou shalt be king over Israel, and I shall be next unto thee, and that also Saul my father knoweth. And you know, in the Hebrew text, there are three words emphasized in the 17th verse, and they are these. Thou shalt be king, I shall be next, and that also Saul my father knoweth. You know, those were the three people that afflicted, as it were, Jonathan's soul in order that he might preserve that right and proper balance of loyalty in all respects. Loyalty to his friend and loyalty to his father. And those are the three things that are emphasized concerning the respective positions of these three men in the 17th verse. Thou shalt be king, he says. And so he assures David of the certainty of his future kingship over Israel. And then he goes on to say, I shall be next unto thee. The Septuagint translation, Green's Jerusalem Bible, Rotherham says, translates the phrase, I shall be to you for second. I shall be to you for second. He doesn't mean next in the sense of standing alongside David. He means next in the sense of standing behind David. I shall be to you for second is the literal translation of the Hebrew. And you see, what he was counseling David on this occasion was that he wants to assure David of his undisputed right to the throne. And I'll be right behind you, says Jonathan. I'll be there, don't worry.
I'll be right behind you. I'll be to you for a second. And he says, Saul, my father knows all of this. Saul, my father knows all of this. You know, if you turn over the page to chapter 24, we're told in the 20th and 21st verse that that's exactly what, in fact, Saul did know, because we're told in the 1st of Samuel 24 and verse 20 that Saul says to David, and now behold, I know well that thou shalt surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in thine hand. Swear now therefore unto me by Yahweh that thou wilt not cut off my seed after me, and that thou wilt not destroy my name out of my father's house. And David sware unto Saul, and Saul went home. But David did not return to the king's court, because he knew that although Saul had said that he understood that David would be king, he knew the heart and mind of a king was fickle. You know what? Perverse obsession of the flesh. When Saul knew that David would be king. And yet we have chapter after chapter thereafter of Saul continuing to hunt David for his life. Jonathan was absolutely right, wasn't he? My father already knows this. Saul was fighting against destiny. And it was the objective of Jonathan to buoy up the spirits of David in the 1st of Samuel 23 verse 17 to encourage his young friend that he might continue in the way and not be faint. And so we're told in the 18th verse of the 1st of Samuel 23, and they too made a covenant before Yahweh, and a number of other codexes add, in the wood. They made a covenant before Yahweh in the wood, and David abode in the wood. And so we come now, therefore, to the third of the three covenants that were made between the three friends. You'll remember that the first covenant was made at the beginning of their friendship. And Jonathan acknowledged David's superior right to the throne by giving him his royal garments. And then as their friendship came under trial and pressure, you'll remember that in the 20th chapter, their covenant was re-pledged amidst sorrow and trial. And Jonathan again acknowledged David's superior right by asking that the covenant mercy of David might be shown to him when David became king. And what do we have here in the 1st of Samuel 23 and verse 16? Well, their covenant now is going to be sealed against their final separation by a mutual vow of undying love and affection. And Jonathan, in the making of this covenant, acknowledges again David's superior right to the throne by confidently declaring his future kingship and assigning to himself the humbler role of standing behind David as second in rank. And that was ever the basis of the covenant between them. You know, when it says that they made a covenant, it is, of course, the two Hebrew words, karat, berit. They cut a covenant. And I believe that they did that three times. They offered a sacrifice in chapter 18 and in chapter 20 and in chapter 23. But it wasn't three covenants, was it? It was actually the re-pledging of the same covenant three times over. But they bound themselves on three occasions to the same principles. Do you know that Saul never understood the basis of that covenant? The karat, berit, between these friends. You see back in chapter 22 and verse 8, we're told there that Saul says, all of you have conspired against me, and there is none that showeth me that my son hath made a league with the son of Jesse. You see that word league there? In the Hebrew, it's the word karat. He's made a cutting with David, or an alliance with David. But what Saul never ever did understand was it wasn't just the cutting, it was a karat berit, the cutting of a covenant between them. He never ever did understand the fullness of the relationship between these two friends. And verse 18 of chapter 23 says that they too therefore made a covenant before Yahweh in the wood, and David abode in the wood. You see the emphasis on the word wood here. You see it back in verse 15? David was in the wilderness of Ziph in a wood. Again in verse 16, went to David in the wood. Again in verse 18, they made a covenant before Yahweh in the wood. The addition of several manuscripts. Again, David abode in the wood. Again in chapter 19, the Ziphites came to Saul and said, doth not David hide himself with us in strongholds in the wood? And there's a decided emphasis on the fact that the covenant on this occasion was to be made between these two friends in the wood. Now the word wood here is the Hebrew word koresh. And it means literally a thicket. It's not a wood in the sense of a forest so much as a thicket. In fact, Jesenius says that the root of the word means to entangle. In other words, it's so thick. The same word is translated in Ezekiel 31 verse 3 as the shadowing shroud. And you see, what we're being told here in this verse is that there is a tremendous sense of foreboding and gloom that overhangs this story as they whisper their vows of love in the shadows of the undergrowth. There is a dark shadow that hangs over this story. Because you see, although Jonathan had said to his friend, I shall be second unto thee, I believe that in Jonathan's heart of hearts, he suspected that that might never be the case. And what I'd like to do now is to try and retrace the thinking of Jonathan's thoughts and feelings with regard to where he would finally stand with David concerning this final covenant made together in the woods. And you see, it all began in chapter 13. I'd like you to come back to chapter 13. I want you to follow this thinking through, as it were, as we consider now the course of Jonathan's final action and why it was that he did what he did. And it all began, you see, back in chapter 13. Because, you see, back there, we're told in the 13th verse that Samuel said to Saul, thou hast done foolishly. Thou hast not kept the commandment of Yahweh thy God, which he commanded thee. For now would Yahweh have established thy kingdom upon Israel forever, but now thy kingdom shall not continue. Yahweh hath sought him a man after his own heart. And you know, you see, brothers and sisters and young people, from that moment, Jonathan understood that he never, ever would be king. But he didn't know who it would be. Not until chapter 18. And when we come to chapter 18 and verse 4, as you'll remember the story, David has now appeared upon the scene, and Jonathan understands that this is the one who was in fact to replace him. And we have that marvellous story in chapter 18 and verse 4, as Jonathan strips himself of the robe that was upon him and gave it to David as a symbol of his allegiance to David as the rightful heir to the throne. And you know, brothers and sisters, if Saul had relinquished the throne at that moment of time, Saul and Jonathan and all his house could have lived in peace under the rule of David. You see, God had said to Saul, the kingdom is taken from thee, not his life. And if Saul had been prepared to hand over the kingdom at that time, he could have enjoyed to live out his life together with Jonathan, his son, under David. And you know, Saul came within a hair's breadth of giving the kingdom to David, chapter 19. The very last verse of chapter 19. There was a moment later on when it almost happened, because we're told in chapter 19 in verse 24 that when Saul came to search for David, who was of course with Samuel and Ramah, that when he got there he stripped off his clothes, says verse 24. You see that word strip? That's the same word used when Jonathan took off his royal robe. And I believe that what Saul did on this occasion was he took off his royal garments and he was within a hair's breadth of giving the kingdom to David. But the moment passed and he didn't do it. And as Saul's obsessive hatred for David increased, there was a growing realization within Jonathan that for the house of David to rise, the house of Saul might have to be removed. And he was the chief heir in that house. I think Jonathan understood that. When we come to the 20th chapter, he appears to indicate his understanding that all may not end as well as we might imagine. You see, at the end of verse 13 of the first of Samuel chapter 20, he says, right at the end of that verse, "And Yahweh be with thee as he hath been with my father." Remember that phrase? You know, the Jerusalem Bible translates it a little more potently when it says, "And Yahweh be with thee as he used to be with my father." You see, Jonathan knew that God had departed from his father. Well, in the case of Yahweh be with thee as he hath been with my father, he's still with my father, he can now be with you, as he used to be. It's gone from my father. Jonathan knew that. And that's why he said in the 14th verse, "And thou shalt not only while I yet live show me the kindness of Yahweh that I die not, but also thou shalt not cut off thy carcass from my house forever if I do die." And Jonathan had a feeling that his life may end in death because he was of the house of Saul. And then he had the confrontation with his father and he sent David away. And the question was, what should he do now? As he watched David walk away and as he walked back into the city, the great conflict that raged in Jonathan's mind was, what do I do now? Where should I go? Where should I stand? What position should I take? And you know what his overriding concern was? He says, "I want to be loyal to Yahweh. I want to be loyal to my father and I want to be loyal to David." He wanted the loftiest of ideals and the highest of standards. Anything else was not good enough for Jonathan. He wanted to do what was best for the troop in every respect. And I believe that he made a decision on that basis. And the decision that he made, brothers and sisters and young people, was to stand with his father. And there were three reasons why Jonathan made that decision. The first was the reason of the matter of the example to the nation. How could he betray his father and walk away from it? What example would that be of filial devotion or of loyalty to the king? But secondly, you see, I think that Jonathan really felt that he could do more for David's cause if he remained at his father's side. If he joined with David's band, he would no longer be able to influence the course of his father's mind and will with regard to David. And I believe that Jonathan believed that he could best help his friend by staying with his father. And the last reason was that Jonathan loved his father, and he never ever gave up the hope of influencing his father for good. And he knew that as long as he was with his father, he had the opportunity that he might influence Saul in right directions. And so he decided to stay with his dad. And yet he made the decision with the conviction that if matters grew worse, that he might perish with the house of Saul. And there were already reasons now growing in the story that made Jonathan feel that his father's position was increasingly hopeless. And one of the things that must have distressed Jonathan exceedingly was the dreadful story of the slaughter of all the priestly house by his father in the first of Samuel chapter 22. You know, Jonathan must have been sickened by that story. All brought about because of his father's consuming hatred against David. And I'm sure that Jonathan would understand that such wickedness in exterminating the priestly house could not go unpunished. You see, I think Jonathan understood that the two houses, the house of Saul and the house of David, were ultimately on a collision course. If you come to the second of Samuel, chapter 3, the record puts it this way. It says there, "Now there was long war between the house of Saul and the house of David, but David waxed stronger and stronger, and the house of Saul waxed weaker and weaker." And the record presents the house of Saul and the house of David as being hopelessly in conflict with one another. And the very activity of Abner and Ishbosheth in these chapters proved that the spirit of rivalry between the house of Saul and the house of David would be there until the very end. And I believe that that was allowed for in the wisdom of God as a final measure of testing for David. But what it proved was this point. If that rivalry was there between those two houses, how could the chief heir of the house of Saul ever stand as advisor behind the throne of the house of David? That was confusion. It was something that couldn't be. And you see, things that were going on in the land at this time were momentous things. And maybe Jonathan contemplated the significance of Genesis 49, and he could see that there wasn't just in this a rivalry between the house of Saul and the house of David, that what was happening here was an impending change marked out by Scripture that was to transfer the scepter from the house of Benjamin to the house of Judah. It wasn't just the rivalry between two families, it was the change of the royal throne from one tribe to another. These were momentous days. And that transfer was best achieved by a clean break with the previous house. And when Jonathan said, "I will be to you for second," I'm sure he wished that that might be so. I'm sure that that was his fond hope. And if God had been pleased to spare him and not his father on Gilboa's slope, then he gladly would have accepted the position of second in rank. But in his heart of hearts, he must have suspected that it might not be so because of the course that he had chosen. Jonathan understood that he was related to an order of things that had to be removed. Now come back to the 1st of Samuel 23. And just look at these two phrases that immediately leap out of the record now with significance concerning Jonathan's position in this matter. 1 Samuel chapter 23 and verse 16. "And Jonathan, Saul's son, arose." Do you know that Jonathan hasn't been described as Saul's son since chapter 19 verse 2? Ever since chapter 19 verse 2 of this record, he's always been just Jonathan. And now all of a sudden the divine record again calls him Jonathan, Saul's son. Why so? Well, you could say that it's a contrast, that how amazing it is that Saul the father is hunting this man and yet the very son of the same man is a friend with him. But we already know that, don't we? That's not really surprising to us in view of our knowledge of Jonathan throughout the story. But you see, I think the force of that phrase, "Jonathan, Saul's son," in verse 16 of this chapter is this, that that was the problem with Jonathan, and he knew it. He was Saul's son, and there was nothing he could do about that. He stood related to that house. He was inextricably linked to that house. And you see what the end of verse 18 says? When they finished making the covenant, it says that David abode in the wood and Jonathan went to his house. I think he already knew that when he went into the woods on this occasion. The die was already cast. He'd already made that choice. But he wanted to encourage his friend. You see, in verse 19 it says that the Ziphites came to Saul, to Gibeah, and said, "Doth not David hide himself with us in strongholds?" You know, David wrote a psalm at this moment of time, and it gives us an insight as to what was going on. Psalm 54. At this very moment of the making of the covenant in the wood between Jonathan and David, David wrote a psalm. And this is what he said in the psalm written just after Jonathan had left him. He says in verse 1, "Save me, O God, by thy name, and judge me by thy strength, and hear my prayer, O God, and give ear to the words of my mouth. For strangers are risen up against me, and oppressors seek after my soul. They have not set God before them. Behold, God is mine helper. Yahweh is with them that uphold my soul." Who was it that upheld David's soul at this moment of time? Who was it that had just come to the woods to strengthen his hand in God? That's Jonathan in verse 4. "Yahweh is with them that uphold my soul." And Jonathan said, "Look, it doesn't matter, David, Yahweh's with it. You'll be king. It'll all work out. Saul, my father, won't find you." And verse 5 says, but David says, "He shall reward evil unto mine enemies. Cut them off in thy truth. I will freely sacrifice unto thee. I will praise thy name, O Yahweh, for it is good. For he hath delivered me out of all trouble. And mine eye now hath seen his desire upon mine enemies." And you know the tragedy of Psalm 54 and verse 7? That Jonathan, the older and wiser of the two, wasn't able to tell his friend that because of his relationship with his father, that he was, in a sense, one of David's enemies. Because he was of Saul's house. You know, shortly after this, David went to Ziklag. And if we come to the first of Chronicles, chapter 12, we're told that something rather interesting happened to him when he arrived at Ziklag. The first of Chronicles, chapter 12. In the first of Chronicles, chapter 12 and verse 1, the record says, "Now these are they that came to David to Ziklag while he yet kept himself close because of Saul the son of Kish." And who was it that came to him? They were among the mighty men, helpers of the war. Ignore the italics. "Armed with bows and could use both the right hand and the left in stones and arrows out of a bow, Saul's brethren of Benjamin." So you see, who fell out to David when David moved to Ziklag? A number of people from different tribes. But among the first of those that came and pledged their loyalty to David were those of Saul's brethren of Benjamin. Did Jonathan go? He had opportunity, you see, if he wished to choose that course. He could have been one of those there. But you see, he'd already made his choice not to go. He was resolute. He'd worked out the conflict of his life. How could he best serve God? How could he best serve the king? How could he best serve his friend? And mark these words. This is the decision he'd made. He decided to cast his lot with his father's decline and not with his friend's rise. That's what he'd done. he decided to cast his lot with his father's decline and not with his friend's rise. And he believed in his heart of hearts that whatever might come as a result of that, that he could best serve David by that means also, and yet be loyal to his father and be faithful to God. What a tremendous decision this man made. It's a principle of true friendship, isn't it? The principle of self-denial. These rather interesting words from Evesheim, Old Testament Bible history. Jonathan, he says, was fully aware of David's future destiny. More than that, he had sad presentiment of the fate of his own house, and yet in full view of it all, he believingly submitted to the will of God and still lovingly clave to his friend. Far more fully and clearly than his father does he see into the future, alike as regards David and the house of Saul. But there is not a tinge of misunderstanding of David, not a shadow of suspicion, not a trace of jealousy, not a word of murmur or complaint. As we think of what it must have cost Jonathan to speak thus, or again of the sad fate which was so soon to overtake him, there is a deep pathos about this brief interview almost unequal in Holy Scripture. Good words. Learning self-denial. You know what the spirit of Jonathan was? He must increase. I must decrease. Isn't that what he decided to do? We're told in the 1st of Samuel and chapter 28, having left the meeting in the woods, they never were, of course, to meet again. They never did see each other again, these two friends. Not at least as far as the record shows it. And now we come to the circumstances of the time of the end, Jonathan having chosen his course, and the record gives us some very interesting detail about the pitching of the final circumstances of the tragedy of Gilboa. You see in the 1st of Samuel chapter 28 and verse 4, we're told there that the Philistines gathered themselves together and came and pitched in Shunem, and Saul gathered all Israel together and they pitched in Gilboa. Now let's just put a map up then of the area and see if we can see where we are in this particular story. You can see running up the centre here, the Jordan Valley and the Sea of Galilee. And running off to one side is the Valley of Jezreel as it makes its way up from the depths of the Jordan Valley up into the widening out of the plain of Esdraelon itself. And you'll see that just to the south of the valley is the beginning of the central Judean mountain range that has its northernmost ending in what is known as Mount Gilboa. You can see Mount Gilboa there. Now you see what the record tells us about the situation of the armies on this occasion. You see verse 4, let's read it again. It says that the Philistine gathered themselves together and came and pitched in Shunem, says the record. Now you see where Shunem is. It's to the north side of the Valley of Jezreel, and it nestled just below the foot of the Hill of Moreh. And where was Israel? Well, Israel was pitched on the other side of the valley, on the slopes of Mount Gilboa. Now come to chapter 29, verse 1. It says that the Philistines gathered together all their armies to Aphek, and the Israelites pitched by a fountain which is in Jezreel. You know, there are three prominent fountains in the valley of Jezreel, but the most prominent and the most famous is that, as we've got it pinpointed here, known as the Spring or Fountain of Herod, which lies directly beneath the base of Gilboa, nearby to the actual city of Jezreel itself, on the south side of the valley of Jezreel. So the Israelites are pitched together by a fountain. It's likely to be the spring of Herod. And in the same chapter at the end of verse 11, the very last sentence says, the Philistines went up to Jezreel. Now Jezreel, of course, is a little further over to the right-hand side, the left-hand side of the spring of Herod, and it is advancing up into the plain of Esdraelon itself. And so what it's saying is that the Philistine armies spread out across the plain as it widens out, further out into the plain of Esdraelon itself. So you see, those are the details that are given to us concerning the position of the Philistines and the Israelites at the beginning of this final battle of Gilboa. Now, why is that all interesting? Come back to Judges, chapter 6, verse 33. Do you know this, brothers and sisters and young people? The story of Gideon came back to haunt Saul at the time of the end. So you think you're Gideon. Now in Judges chapter 6 and verse 33 we're told that the Midianites and the Amalekites in the days of Gideon and the children of the east were gathered together and went over and pitched in the valley of Jezreel. Where's the valley of Jezreel? Well, it's exactly where the host of the Philistines was spreading out into the valley. Where were the Israelites? Chapter 7, verse 1 says, then Jerubbaal, who is Gideon, and all the people that were with him rose up early and pitched beside the fountain or spring of Herod, so that the host of the Midianites were on the north side of them by the hill of Moreh. So the Midianites are just beneath the hill of Moreh on the north side of the valley. That's exactly where the Philistines encamped in the days of Saul at Shunem. So the host of the Philistines is exactly where the Midianites were in the days of Gideon. And where's the host of Gideon on this occasion? Well, we're told in verse 1 that they were pitched beside the well of Herod, but it ought not to be translated beside the well of Herod. It ought to be translated that they were pitched above the well of Herod. And that's confirmed by verse 4, because in verse 4 it says that Yahweh said unto Gideon, the people are yet too many, bring them down to the water. So they came down into the valley to the spring of Herod. And at the end of verse 8 we're told, and the host of Midian was beneath him in the valley. There's only one place, my dear brothers and sisters and young people, where Gideon could have been to satisfy the requirements of Judges 7, verse 1, 4, and 8. So that the Midianites were across the valley, but underneath them in the valley, so that the spring of Herod lay below him, so that they might go down to the water. There's only one place where he could have been. Gideon was on the slopes of Mount Gilboa. And that's where Saul finds himself in the 1st of Samuel chapter 31 and verse 1 as we come back now to the story. But he hasn't got the faith of Gideon. And he hasn't got the humility of Gideon. And this place, which was the site of one of the most amazing victories that Israel ever won, is now to become the scene of their most tragic defeat. And we're told in chapter 31 then of the 1st of Samuel and verse 1, now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell down slain in Mount Gilboa. There's something very strange about this verse, because you see, the very spirit of the verse breathes out to us that it's almost as if Israel were finished before they had started. The Philistines fought, and the men of Israel fled. The battle was over before it had begun, despite the fact that they'd taken the high ground. Here they are, up on the slopes of Mount Gilboa. Any advance from the Philistines has to come from the valley floor beneath them, up onto the slopes, with the Philistines fighting up the hill. All the disadvantage lies with the Philistines. And yet, despite that, we're told here that there was almost a rout immediately, and the Israelites felt, I think there were three reasons why the battle went against Israel so decisively in the 1st of Samuel 31, verse 1. Here they are. Reason number one. Saul had spent the previous night in the company of the witch of Endor. And she had told him, "Tomorrow thou shalt be with Samuel dead, and thy sons with thee." 1 Samuel 28, verse 19. And Saul went back in a daze after his experience at Endor, a man whose spirit now was absolutely broken. And I believe that the spirit of despair that was evident in the king on the next morning must have sapped the morale of his troops. They looked at the king and they saw despair all over his face, and they knew that the battle was lost. That's the first reason. And here's the second. You see, the cream of the army, according to the 1st of Chronicles 12, which we've already looked at, the cream of the army had already gone to David at Ziklag. Many of the mighty men of many of the tribes had already defected to David. Do you know what Saul was left with? Most of the Gibor had gone. There was no Ish left. When it says in verse 1, "And the men of Israel fled," the word "men" is the word Enosh. That's all Saul's got left. The Enoshim of Israel. The weak, mortal creatures that were left under his hand. And you know the third reason why the battle went against them? Deuteronomy chapter 20. In the book of Deuteronomy, and in the 20th chapter, and verse 1, it says there, "When thou goest out to battle against thine enemies, and seest horses and chariots and a people more than thou, be not afraid of them. For Yahweh thy God is with thee, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And it shall be, when ye come nigh unto the battle, that the priest shall approach and speak unto the people, and shall say unto them, Hear, O Israel, ye approach this day unto battle against your enemies. Let not your heart faint, fear not, and do not tremble, neither be terrified because of them. For Yahweh your God is he that goeth with you to fight for you against your enemies, to save you." Before the battle began, the priests went out to bless the soldiers. But Saul has slain all the priestly house. And there's only one left. And he's with David. And there's no hope for Saul, is there? And so verse 2 of the 1st of Samuel 31 says, "And the Philistines followed hard upon Saul and upon his sons. And the Philistines slew Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, Saul's son." And the implication of the story is that, you see, Saul's sons formed part of the bodyguard that rallied against the king as the rest of the army fled helter-skelter down into the Jordan Valley and across the Jordan and away safely to escape away. His sons formed part of the bodyguard that rallied about the king for a last desperate stand against the advancing Philistines. And an arrow found Jonathan, and he fell there on the mountain. And he died, brothers and sisters, in order that his father might live. What a spirit. And as he died, I'm sure that his heart was 80 miles to the south with David in Ziklag. He'd really died so that David's cause might be advanced. It wouldn't have been long, probably just a few short moments, the last few breaths, the glazed eyes, the quiver of the body, and a great man fell lifeless on the slopes. Loyal to the end. And verse 3 says, and the battle went sore against Saul, and the archers hit him, and he was sore wounded of the archers. It says the archers hit him, and the margin says men with bows, the bowmen. And isn't it remarkable that that was the very aspect of war in which the tribe of Benjamin excelled? They were archers, the tribe of Benjamin. And the house of Saul, including Saul himself, are now overtaken by the archers of the Philistines. How symbolic of the overthrow of the house of Benjamin so completely on this occasion that it's the archers that find them. And verse 4 says that Saul said unto his armor bearer, draw thy sword and thrust me through, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and abuse me. But his armor bearer would not, for he was sore afraid, and therefore Saul took a sword and fell upon it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he fell likewise upon his sword and died with him. I gave thee a king in mine anger, says Hosea chapter 13, verse 11. And I took him away in my wrath. And verse 6 says, so Saul died, and his three sons, and his armor bearer, and all his men, that same day together. You see the force of the text there? So Saul died, and his three sons, and his armor bearer, and all his men, the same day together. It was total and absolute. Come to the first of Chronicles, chapter 10, which is the parallel record, and just see what Chronicles says as it expresses the force of that same verse. Put it slightly differently. In the first of Chronicles, chapter 10, and reading from verse 5, we have the Chronicles account of the same story. And it says there, when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he fell likewise on the sword and died. So Saul died, and his three sons, and all his house died together. It was as Jonathan feared. The house of Saul was finally taken away in the wisdom of God because it sought to resist the incoming majesty of the Davidic tide. And Jonathan fell with that house. And the triumph of the Philistines on that day on Mount Gilboa was not that they had just killed Saul, the king of Israel, but that in one decisive blow they had cut off all the flower of his house. All there was a son left, and Abner had escaped, but to all intents and purposes, the house of Saul had been given its death blow on that day, and Jonathan died. As the forerunner to the beloved, he was taken away. Maybe John the Baptist thought about that. I believe that Jonathan was beheaded along with his father. He became the forerunner of the death of John. Beheaded after the same manner. Taken away in his own day. That the house of Christ might increase. What do we learn then from the story of Jonathan this day? Jonathan the selfless, the man who gave loving counsel and walked away to tragic death. You see, the finest of friendships are those that are nourished by the sweetness of counsel from the heart. True counsel is that which strengthens, that which braces, that which consoles. Even when we're powerless to advance right, we can at least abstain from evil. The disciples of the beloved will practice that resolute choosing of the course which will best advance the truth, even to present loss and suffering. Jonathan beautifully manifested this spirit of self-denial by casting his lot with his father's decline and not with his friend's rise. He fell united with Saul in death, but knit with David for the life to come. And so he will be, brothers and sisters and young people, when the new age dawns and the graves are opened that the dead might stand again. Jonathan, indeed, on this occasion, had become, as he lay lifeless upon the slopes of Gilboa, in every way, Jonathan the selfless.